You're listening to the oneofus.net podcast network.
Hoot, hoot, hoot. You know, inside. Oh, that's good. You should do that. Do that again. Is that owls make that noise? That sounds more authentic.
Yeah, it's better.
Yeah, it's probably better. Just edit my whole thing out.
We're not going to sit here and make owl noises.
Yeah, we're not. Okay, yeah. But no, we are. Inside, I feel like I'm an owl boy. You know?
Like, I think I did hint at in this upcoming interview that I did really feel like the character at the very beginning. Like,
yeah.
It's just, it is a very transitional type thing. He feels very teenager-esque.
Mm-hmm, and so. A little angsty.
Yeah.
But not, like, annoying or anything.
No. Like, unsure. And it's, like, yes. I hope this is perfect, like, teen kind of game. I think.
Oh, it definitely is. I mean, all the teenagers are streaming this thing. Because, of course, we're talking about Owlboy, Deephead Studios. Universally acclaimed a side scroller.
It's good.
Yeah, you and I have been playing it, and we were lucky enough to get in touch with one of the developers for the game, Adrian Bauer. And you can hear his thoughts on the game and all of our questions with him right now. Man, oh man, John, we're making our way up in the world now, getting all these interviews, talking to all these fantastic developers and voice actors. This We Are Era is going to be on the map.
Yeah, I hope so. I really cannot believe how fast a lot of things are going. Mm-hmm. Panels, interviews, stuff like that. And, yeah. You know, the episodes that we put out every week. So
absolutely. And of course, today's interview features one of my favorite games, I think, in like the last year, I'd say, you know, Owlboy. And today we have a programmer slash designer, writer, illustrator. He's a renaissance man of video game development. We have Mr. Adrian Bauer. Adrian, thanks for coming on We Are Air today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. Well, if we just kind of want to get right into it, what was your kind of specific role in the development of Owlboy?
Well, I didn't so much do programming as I did some help with, like, I helped the programmers, I guess, transpose information so that other people could understand it, or just help them with a bit of logic here and there, but it... I was mainly level design and design, and then helping with writing and some other things here and there. We all kind of had to wear multiple hats. Joe was primarily like the front end programmer, making everything kind of feel right. He can't be here today, friend's birthday, but he ended up taking a lot of like the engines that Henrik could make, Henrik wrote most of the engine and all of the back-end stuff and everything else that makes the game run smoothly, but nobody kind of understands until you actually, like, point out the systems. Simon did all the artwork, just absolutely everything, and Jonathan did all of the music. And we also had a bit of help for sound effects from our friend Martin, who worked on Goner and Among Sleep and some other games. Great guy. And that's basically all of us.
Yeah, I did want to ask on what you were doing with the whole level design. Owlboy being someone who makes good use, I guess is a good way to say it, of the space of the world, being able to fly and traverse. How was it developing that, designing that, trying to keep that in mind that the player will try and push every nook and cranny they can of the world you created?
So that was really interesting to do, because a lot of the time there is this kind of gauging space and how much space you have. And since you could fly into any wall and any sort of corner, any kind of nook and cranny, there's a lot of incentive to just go everywhere, and that made debugging really difficult, I guess, for, like, map editing, because I had to, like, go into every single wall at every single angle and try to make sure that nothing would screw up with the camera or the parallax. After a while of working on this, you can't really use any tropes that you know of other games, and in some cases, they just don't fit at all with, say, the story or the level design that you're going for. And it's a bit of a challenge because a lot of it is just a bit of uncharted territory. But considering how much time we had on it, the nice thing about that is that we became really experienced and really mature in what we were doing. Like, it was our own project that we'd kind of redone. Not really redone, but, you know, we'd revised so many things and learned so many things that it's, we became very, just natural with it.
What can you, speak to, like, with your inspiration for the game? Of course, you kind of went through all these different iterations and you kind of, like, started over at some points, but what was the original inspiration for the game?
The original inspiration, came from Simon. He's the one who started all of this. It started with kind of like Kid Icarus and, some other games, and we started dogpiling our own, takes on things, but I'd say Kid Icarus was probably the originator of everything.
Going back off what you had said initially too, I remember reading that it inspired it, and how do you bring Kid Icarus to 3D, and did it really belong? Development started around 2007, so before Uprising, I think is what the 3DS game is called. So you did mention it, you spent so long with it. I think I heard that the design on the game did go through multiple iterations. It got started over. How was that, like, for you personally? You had said that it's kind of hard. You had to think outside the box about, there weren't games that were exactly doing what you were trying to do. So how was that? Like, how much of Kid Icarus could you take? Or were there any other games that you, when you thought, how is the player going to explore this world, when you came to make it?
Well, I didn't take too much from Kid Icarus. I took more from, Herbie and, Wonder Boy, a few other games that I really like. I tried to take, instead of trying to take ideas from things, I just tried to break down what I understood the games to be doing. Mm-hmm. So for like Wonder Boy, it was sort of an early Metroidvania. I mean, it was just recently remade and I haven't had a chance to play it because I don't have a Switch. I'm waiting for the Steam version. And one of the things that was interesting about that game is that there's always secrets in plain sight behind the wall, because the camera didn't lock to just the room you're in. A lot of rooms where they made, like, say, this is kind of common in game design sometimes, well, in older games, where, say, you go into a village and you go into a house, instead of every single house being an individual map in the game, they're actually one gigantic map where they're padded out quite a bit, so you can never see the other houses. That improves load times and helps debug things, or it helps make things simple so that you don't have as many problems. So within Wonder Boy, you've got a lot of areas that are very interconnected, and you'll drop into an area and you'll see a room that's to the left, and there is no actual way to get to it from the area that you're in. And the game is designed around transformations and other paths and being put on rails to other areas. So I started thinking a lot about how, since you've got that, ability to just go into every corner and go anywhere you want, when do I want to show something through the wall? When do I want to completely block off and focus the person? It's things like that that got me really interested, because it sets up these kind of these sort of long-term or side goals for, like, oh, I saw a treasure chest over there, I wonder how I can go get it. Say for the intro, there's this one area that's called Stratos, and Stratos has got this kind of green sky and everything, and to the left and right of the opening, I guess the lobby area, you can see these treasure chests that are behind spike walls or spike vines, it's not really apparently clear how you can get to them, but there's only one path out, and that's going straight up, and that's the main path that goes towards the next dungeon. And for the people who are going along there, they'll see branching paths that are kind of given a lower priority by the camera. So the camera isn't locking in or trying to show you, hey, look at this thing to the side. And it's always just kind of like, well, if I want that treasure, I'm probably going to have to go one of these directions and find my way around. And things like that, that just... I really like that about some of the older games, like Wonder Boy, where they just do that. They tease you with something, and you've got to figure out how you can get to it.
Was that kind of your overall gameplay philosophy where, of course, you wanted to challenge the player, but you also wanted them to freely explore the world and kind of also use one of the things I did like about really liked about the game was kind of how you use like companion characters and how they interact with the world.
Mm-hmm. So the companion characters... We started off thinking, oh yeah, you know, this will be cool. Your gunners are your power ups and whatever are just other gunners, and just it's different because you can add some expressions to them, and it's because it adds to the whole like you've got a friend on the adventure kind of thing, and everyone's got a little bit different, but some, like, it's always kind of nice to go on an adventure with someone else to share the experience with or be able to talk about it with. And so we started thinking more about how the gunners should be, like, the gunners' relationship to Otis and how everything kind of stays within kind of a small character bubble. That was more important than a larger kind of crazy overarching epic story about this and that. The real focus is on character interactions and making that kind of meaningful. So we spent a lot of time just kind of making sure that the gunners were never like useless or frustrating or strange mechanically. And that kind of plays into the making... That's one of those small things about in, I guess... helping your player engage or, I guess, like the NPCs or the side characters. In some games, you'll have, like, some character who is just useless. You know, like in RPGs where you've got that one party member who's just like, fuck, that guy. You don't want them in your team. You never want them around. They're just useless mechanically or they're useless strategically or something, and because of that, you want nothing to do with it. You don't care about them. It's kind of like this weird, you do nothing for this game. You do nothing for me. You make my experience kind of frustrating. So we tried to make sure that all of the gunners were unique and interesting and helpful, and you could play as any of them more or less, and, you could enjoy the game. You would never feel like, one of the gunners is just absolutely useless. You would feel more like, oh, I should swap between them and I should use the right one for the right situation, but it's not like they're useless or I should stop using Getty or something. No obsoletes, no obsolescence. So that kind of played into the mechanics driving the character story.
And when taking those kind of characters into account and thinking about the development process as a whole, I was wondering what were the steps in that whole process? So did the world come first and then you thought about the characters and how they would fit in? Or was it, I want a gunner like Getty to be involved. How do I shape the design of this world to him?
I'd say it all kind of came in at different angles because Simon had an idea of what he wanted his characters to be. And visually he knew what they were going to be. Mechanically, they kind of got revised and changed. As for the world, that also came, like, sometimes I'd be building something that is like, well, this fits the size and shape of the character, or this would be better for, like, these mechanics. And that's part of the revision, where, like, minor things, say, Getty, depending on which year and which version you're playing, his gun had different rates of fire and different bursts. So it would be like a burst of 3 if you hold down the button, or you like a really fast rapid fire, or a really long range shot, or just a really slow pew, 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 pew. And those really impacted what kind of things you would put into the level and what kind of world you'd build around the characters mechanically. Because at its core, the level design had to be functional. It had to convey information. It had to work with the enemy designs and the characters or the abilities that you get. And then it had to look pretty, and it had to have things that stood out. So as for world building, it's sort of like that was a bit more detached from the characters, or at least the visuals of the world, where we tried to root everything mechanically, at least assumes everything was more stable with the mechanics, and we could fine tune how gunners worked in every situation.
I'm just curious, how did you first come to be involved with Owlboy? Were you there from the beginning, or did you enter in like a few years after the game had already been started development?
I started there like way at the beginning. So years before we started on Owlboy, I was working on this game called Rhapsody, and it's from the Click and Play community, and it's probably completely gone, and you should not look it up because it was terrible. And I was doing the artwork for that, and some other programming for it, and we had our artist kind of dropped out. He was just busy, and Simon wanted to join in, so he started drawing sprite art, and he started revising some of my backgrounds a bit, just adding details and things. And then we also had a friend, Blake, who was the original programmer on Owlboy. Like, he worked on the prototype. And so we switched over and we started working on this idea that Simon had for a flying game. And we just kind of dropped Rhapsody and started going full bore on Owlboy. Jonathan was also there at the beginning. He was sort of like the silent partner. And then we started really contacting him and talking to him more as Owlboy kind of picked up. And then Joe and Henrik joined in.
So what was that like working in such a small team, especially when there are transitions? Is it just a more intimate environment? Do you get to understand the meanings behind like Simon's general idea? Is it easier for you to understand what his point of view is and translate that into design work and just... I don't know your experience with bigger teams, and can you speak to that, just like working in an intimate setting like that?
I mean, it helps that we're all like buddies to begin with. We talked a lot about art. This is kind of going back to the whole like middleman of a lot of things. Because I can draw and I kind of understand drawing and art and things, it's easy for me to understand what Simon's trying to say. He's also speaking English as a second language, and his designs are really strong, so he's able to communicate quite well, and I can understand what he's doing, or at least pick up the conversation of what he's trying to do with the visuals. For the writing and the programming, if someone's got an idea for a mechanic that doesn't fit like the story, or maybe it sort of fits, it's easy for me to talk to Henrik about what he's trying to make and communicate just how to make something fun or what I'm trying to do. I guess for a smaller team, it's easy and it's difficult. What's difficult about working in a small team is that everyone's used to working either solo or like with one other person. So that for us was a kind of a gradual step. And like we went from being these indies who had to just do all of our art, all of our programming, all of our everything, maybe get a friend to do some music or did our own music. And, learning that, you know, you have to trust other people to take on something, and you know, someone else is more specialized in something than you are. It's a lot of growing, and it's just I don't really have a ton of experience with like larger teams for comparison. I guess because my only other comparison would be just university and doing group projects and how horrible that always is. So I've always been used to small teams. But regardless of small or large team, communication and project management, stuff like that, having just setting goals and things, those are just universal. So it's, I guess there's some things that are really neat about working in a small team. But yeah.
And, you know, you talk, going off of that being intimate and understanding Simon's design and his general ideas, something I really liked about the character of Otis is from the get-go, we can tell he's timid, he's unsure, and he's very teenager-esque in a way. Even the way he's built seems sort of like he's getting to maturity. Did you get a deeper understanding of that from like Simon's own personal experiences? And was it, since everyone is so close and like you said, you guys are friends, was that easier to translate across in just how this character feels kind of like the player? He is foreign to this world in a sense. He lives there, but he obviously isn't fully embraced quite yet.
It's sort of a, getting those characters into writing and actually making them kind of come alive beyond just the visuals. That was a lot of Henrik's work. And you spend a lot of time with these scenes that are trying to utilize the expressions as best as possible. Some things you can't really, you can't really bend some things visually into story. There are certain, like, every character has, like, emotion, they have expressions that they can do. They have a pretty wide range of talking animations or just general ways of emoting. And I think Simon did a really good job of just trying to, like, we worked with him as we tried to write out what a scene would be and who these characters were going to be in a final version. A lot of animations were like set in stone, but Simon did such a good job of making them like very, they're specific to the character, but they also don't feel like they're completely locked to a personality. Or in some cases, we were able to use more expression, more of a, say, Getty's flailing, like his sort of dancing flail. Because we got to use it, because we decided to use it a lot more, and we just had more scenes written around that, we didn't have to really ask Simon to revise anything for the art. So it became sort of this mix of what are you writing, how often are you showing something, and what is it actually doing? And it kind of, well, the nice thing about using sprite art is that there's a lot more interpretation of what's going on. There's there are fewer absolutes, I guess, and there's a more not uncanny valley, but there's ambiguity in the sprite art, and that makes it easier to just kind of tweak things and just show fewer times of Otis scared, or maybe more scared, and that all kind of comes together, like in the sum of things.
Yeah, what I actually, just going off of what you said about kind of the art and just the writing, I kind of felt like an immediate sense of like warmth playing the game. It kind of reminded me to a certain extent of like a Miyazaki movie, like Castle in the Sky or Princess Mononoke, where it's like it feels like this old world that's been around for so long, and there's so much history with it, and all the characters like have very distinct personalities, even whether, you know, we're reading about their, even when it comes to their design or when you're just reading their text bubbles. I mean, did you want to convey like a sense of warmth or just like history in the world that you built?
Absolutely. The sense of history was something that Henrik and I were constantly working on. I liked to spend a lot of time revising areas and making them look less handmade, or I guess less constructed, more falling apart, regardless of if they were man-made or not. And constantly trying to put, like, Simon has a lot of decaying statues and things, but there's also decay. Geologically, there's decay, and trying to just break up what would otherwise be, there's kind of like warm looking happy platformers in other games that have very like square line, like just very flat lines, square edges, that sort of thing, and making very uneven or broken up landscapes. Something that just goes in hand with the whole, you know, fact that everything is floating and land masses are just kind of constantly shifting around. So there was a lot just in that alone that gave it history. And then there's little details that just kind of added to the age of things, here and there, like a couple of skulls and some other things, just in weird places. After the first dungeon, or the cloud dungeon, you can get into this big kind of water garden kind of area, and there's a lot of stuff that's just kind of like broken down, falling apart, things that look like it could have been an aqueduct or something. And there's just some of these like couple of skulls that are, or some bones in general that are just off in some really precarious and odd corners of the map. They're just like, how did you get up here? And wow, you've been up here a long time. And things like that just, trying to show that this place has been around for a long time. It may not have been used for a long time. But having the, like a flashback, there was that flashback scene, with Alphonse talking about the old world and seeing what it looked like when it was new versus all of the things that you've spent so long kind of venturing through. Things like that add like huge contrast, and make you think more about like how far things have degraded, or at least just with time. But as for the Miyazaki stuff, a lot of that stuff was, I'd say like everyone on the team really enjoys that's like his work. Or like his team's work. Ghibli movies in general are like a huge inspiration for like the things that I draw and the things that I write. I really like the sort of simple contrasting characters that in general, no one's an asshole. There's realism in that everyone is sort of fleshed out and everyone's kind of got their thing, their own bit of baggage, but there's very few assholes in a Miyazaki movie, and that's kind of like a nice thing that we tried to pick up on, is that if someone's maybe a bit rough, there might be a reason why they're rough, and so on, and it's to do with the whole character story focus and empathy and just trying to convey that people are people, or at least, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's yeah, you bring that up. That's so interesting. It's a surprisingly emotional game throughout. And I usually just don't.
That's fake people.
Yeah, I usually just don't like associate that type of storytelling with, a 2D side scroll or a 2D platformer, but that immediately comes across. Did you want to make sure that, like, players would have an emotional reaction at like key points during the game, whether it be through their characters or a particular story segment?
Yeah, exactly. We definitely wanted to make sure that there was emotional reaction. We didn't want anything to come off as flat and boring and uninteresting. The last thing we wanted is people to be indifferent or just unengaged. We wanted people to feel just like they wanted to see the next event. They wanted to see the next scene. They wanted to see what happens. There's a lot of little things in that. One of the last passes I did on the dialogue, is I added character expressions wherever possible because Otis doesn't say anything, but Otis has to pantomime absolutely everything. Having him react or choose not to react to things helps say volumes about just his relationship to other characters. And I think just having those little details, even if Otis isn't really in the middle of a conversation, having Otis like react to a conversation on the side gets noticed. It adds to the whole actual characters actually involved in what's going on. The indifference of characters to the story and the world is really interesting. This is more of a problem with really expensive games, is that you've got so many details flying around about the world, so many graphical splendors, and then you completely whiff when it comes to how a character should react to something in a minute way that I think people will always pick up on. It's like the extreme case is when you're in a really serious scene, but your character can jump around like a jackass and just do things. And it's just like, I'm giving you important information and you're jumping on tables and shit. And it's just like that, that's a whole other thing. But like, you get into a conversation where people are, like, this is an important scene. This is an important emotional wrap up to an event. And you don't even see character mouths moving. You don't even see characters making eye contact or turning to other characters when they talk. It just becomes really strange. It's bizarre when you see characters. You have so few characters in a scene, but the only characters that matter are the character that has dialogue at that moment and the character who is the target of that dialogue. And it's like, that's not how conversations in groups of people work. That everyone is generally engaged to some extent and being able to pick out their engagement or whatever, because you're watching the whole thing. So there shouldn't be these kind of like voids, these just abysses of emotion. Everyone should be engaged in the conversation that's being had, or else why even bother having it? Why not just get rid of all the other characters? So there's little details like that that just, without them, everything kind of becomes hollow, and when you look at them again, you go, wow, why doesn't that character give a shit about anything going on in this conversation? Or never does. And it makes it a little more alien and strange.
No, yeah, this isn't exactly a question, but more a comment on that. I actually forgot plenty of times that Otis was mute because his expressionism is so is so particular, large but small and subtle at the same time. One of my favorite expressions is just like his eyes just kind of do that sort of anime-esque thing where it's just like a black dot and he's just kind of shocked. And I also love when the Buccaneer, her little minions show up and they're just like so explosive with their expressions. It just...
Yeah.
In the characters are constantly interacting and reacting to each other through facial animations and just regular animations that you kind of forget that Otis can't talk. And I just wanted to say that, like, for people who haven't played the game, that is definitely a highlight in just building a character in a world and just relationships without words.
Yeah. It's part of the, if your character isn't speaking, they've got to show some other way of speaking or like communication. And, there's a number of times just in like other media, like movies. And, I don't want to get too far into this, but it's like, there are things that are done for the world and there's things that are done for the audience. And, do you remember a movie called 28 Days Later?
Yeah, of course. With Danny Boyle. Yeah. He directed that.
Yeah. So there's a scene in the courtyard where they've got a bunch of those draped, just shaggy, whatever, just cloths and stuff in the courtyard, and there's a zombie that's on a chain. And looking at the scene from, like, any perspective of inside the world, these soldiers have this zombie chained up in a courtyard because for reasons or whatever. But for them... it would make no sense for them to have all of these tablecloths and other ragged pieces of shit hanging on clotheslines to block view of this monster in the courtyard. But the thing is, that isn't interesting or scary for the audience. It's interesting and scary for the audience to have this thing come through all of those, like, out of the shadows and out of the fog kind of thing to jump at the camera. That's writing for the audience. And, the intro to that movie is also the same thing, where you've got this dank, creepy, just dripping cellar, kind of science lab thing where they're doing experiments on monkeys. And it's just like, that would never be the case in any sort of lab, not just from like a budget thing, but like your results and everything could be contaminated and screwed up. Like, you would never, ever, ever want to do what they were trying to do in such a disgusting place. Like, not even, you would think that anyone would try to clean it up and renovate it or do something, so they didn't have their samples being destroyed and, just whatever. But, for the audience, it's awesome. It sets up a mood. It sets up all of these things that you as the watcher needs, but it doesn't make any sense to the actual world of like the movie. So there's this balance of trying to always remember what is kind of for the world and what is a bit for the audience. And you always kind of have to balance a bit of the both, because otherwise your audience isn't being engaged. I mean, there are things in the world that are they're engaging, and they become intrinsically engaging just because the person watching or playing has a vested interest in it. You finally hook them, and then they suddenly care about everything that's going on in the world. But before you hook them, there is still things that there are things that need to be done for anyone who is still feeling like an outsider to it, who's still like just on the bench wondering what's this place.
Well, speaking of the audience, I mean, the game has been getting, I think, near universal acclaim at this point. I mean, after working on this game for so long, for 10 years, what's it been like to just to witness the positive reaction to it?
Kind of nuts. it's just like, wow. It's still kind of like, is this real?
Yeah, it's probably like a nice just sense of like vindication, like all that effort that you just put into it. And to just see that, I mean, the game is like, it's been nominated for countless awards. You know, people are always talking about it. And we're going to, you know, obviously push it on our audience too. Just, you know, get them to obviously play it.
It's really cool. I mean, it's neat. What I find the most interesting about it is the people who have like a really strong emotional response to everything. A lot of it is just like, I'm crying, or something like that, or, oh boy, why'd you make me feel this way, mm-hmm. or something like that. And it's interesting because the game is a solitary experience for a player. But at the same time, if someone's streaming it, everyone is really emotionally engaged in it. When events come up, like I don't hang out in a lot of Twitch streams, just because there's like only so much I can take of like my own like game. It's just like I can't eat mac and cheese every day. But like I still try to drop in. But when I was watching a lot more streams, it would just be this wave of people getting like crazy over every scene that happened, or something shocking, or something sad, or something that's like really happy, or whatever. And it was just this really, really interesting thing to watch. Just having people just really hook into it. I mean, for a game that's not like trying to flash any sort of like crazy multiplayer and online this and that, or any other shared experience where you can like take screenshots and show off what you did and achievements and blah, blah, blah. Like it's a very, very traditional game in that sense. It's still like, whether it's a single person who is just playing it and wants to express themselves, like what it did for them, or they're in a group, and they just get swept up in it. And I think that's really powerful and really like just the coolest thing.
No, yeah, I can definitely speak to that. When I was playing it very early on, I talked about how Owlboy, he seems very unsure and emotive. I think, especially for me in particular, someone kind of dealing with anxiety lately and, you know, fresh out of school. So it's that idea, just like, am I ready for this new adventure? That kind of thing. And I can see how Owlboy really hits people hard, especially it wraps up these bigger ideas about unassuredness and just like going out for the first time on your own, in a nice, cute, fun package, in one that is well designed. So I did just want to add on to that. Something I was wondering actually is, you know, you had spoke about 28 Days Later. I was just wondering about you personally, now that the game is out and maybe you get a few moments to relax, are there any sort of places, movies, maybe magazines or other games that you are finding inspiration of, or you know, just as a designer, what do you seek out now?
I kind of seek out just about anything I can. I just kind of, I'm a voracious reader, and I enjoy like media in general. So I haven't had a chance to get back to a lot of books, but like my day job is just working in an office, and I do data entry for an oil company and stuff, and just audit people who can't type. And I get a lot of time because I did some programming to basically make my job super easy. I get a lot of time to listen to audiobooks. So I've gone through the entire Discworld series. I've gone through a ton of Neil Gaiman. I've gone through a ton of other like old whimsical fantasy stuff, some sci-fi that I've been meaning to get through, like some cyberpunk and some more modern stuff. As for games, I really enjoyed Odalis by Joy Masher. I'm playing Nier Automata right now. And what else? I'm going through some other games. Cosmic Star Heroine came out. That one's been on my like play for here and there. I helped beta test it a little bit. Movies that have come out. The Marvel movies are like, they're pretty fun and exciting. They're super safe movies, but they're like still kind of fun and engaging. Telltale games have been pretty good. What else have I been playing? I'm playing a few classic games here and there. Just a lot of stuff. It, like, off the top of my head, I'm just like, I can't name anything.
Yeah. Well, as you said, that Wonder Boy, I think it's a remake or sort of just reintroduction is coming to the Switch. And so I bet that's something to look forward to as well.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that because the thing about like retro games for me and for the rest of the team is that I've had this comment kind of thrown at me, but like this praise is that a lot of old games are not really great to play. They're just not saying like, oh, old games are bad. There's a lot of games that are built for a particular mindset and a particular kind of like lifestyle, and I don't have that like summer vacation lifestyle. I don't have that sort of like Saturday morning cartoon life. I don't have a lot of those things. So I don't really have the time or the engagement to be like battered over the head for like a couple of sloppy controls or really weird grinding in games and stuff like that. And that's sort of just, you know, that's what happens when you get older and life changes. And the things that you can enjoy, you maybe don't have the time for, or you just kind of, you're tired of having thrust upon you. So, it's interesting to see games that remember what it's like to have an old game, but don't play like an old game. Shovel Knight is probably the best example I can think of, is that, yes, it's like DuckTales and Mega Man and all of these other games, but it doesn't make me pissed off like playing an old game with like really unfair situations that are meant to just grind you into the dirt. They're meant to, like, Shovel Knight is an easy game just because I'm so used to platforming, but it's a smooth experience that's just fun to play, and it reminds me of what it's like to play old games on like my Master System and stuff. It reminds me of like good times with like without the frustration of playing, like the frustration of a challenge, but it, you know, wanting to surpass it before I have to go to bed. Whereas these days it's like, you know, I've got some plumbing to do, or I've got to work on the house, or I've this and that, you know, I've got responsibilities and things. So it's like, I can't really just sit down and say, go away, world. And it's nice to be able to play a game that brings up good feelings of like simple mechanics or very straightforward mechanics without the frustration of what games used to do, just to keep the game going. Like a 30-minute game that like lasts more than, you know, a couple of days because it's so just blisteringly stupid in like some section or something.
Yeah.
I'm really happy to be able to draw upon that, and everyone else on the team as well. And a lot of people have noticed that too. It's just like, it's a classic game without the frustrations of it being archaic.
John and I are actually like huge fans of Shovel Knight, And I mean, we recently reviewed that game, yeah. And of course, we're excited to play the Plague Knight DLC and also the Spectre of Torment DLC, because that's a total like inspiration from Castlevania. So,
but I can definitely understand as two guys who work full time jobs and do this podcast stuff on the side, like having a game that is hard for no reason, like it's just hard because it's like, oh, we need to make sure you spend more time with it, or even like super long RPGs that kind of pad out the time. So I completely understand what you mean. It's like, I just want a game that is like good, tight, and it's like a concise. It does not waste your time. So. Yeah.
That's something I'm seeing with a lot more. I mean, after, you know, we went through that whole like 50, 100, 500,000 hour or game or all this other shit, you know, like you'll be playing this for like 10 years and just, but you'll be padded out constantly for just boring content or things that are just half-assed. It's nice to see that a lot of like streamers and a lot of people, like a lot of the people in like just who play games and buy games and actually finish them, are looking for a concise game, like a game that is not there to waste your time. It's not there to make you pissed off at the game. It's just like, no, you know what, you can sit down and play this in a weekend and have fun and enjoy it and have that experience and be like, I'm done with this. And I really enjoyed that. And, you know, move on.
Yeah. And if you have any like kind of advice for developers or people that are kind of want to go into independent development, I mean, what would you say to them?
Make sure that you're financially stable.
Yeah.
Going in, you're going to have to work some insane hours just to try and pull it off. And while I was working on Owlboy, I mean for the last like 3 years when I moved up to northern Alberta, the life is basically go to work, get up at 6 to 6:30 in the morning, usually 6, work on Owlboy, check in with the team, pass around some design stuff, do whatever I can on the levels for about an hour, hour and a half, go to work, talk to the guys, just like typing on my phone or whatever to keep track and give advice and things on like design choices or whatever projects and goals. Get home, work, you know, until midnight on the game, and then just do it again over and over and over again. And sometimes I didn't get a chance to work on it because I had to reno something or finish the basement or do some other thing. And it's kind of like a brutal grind. And I'd have like one or two people say, hey, why don't you want to go do something? You have free time. They say, I don't. I really don't.
I understand that. I need to.
And unless you're willing to put into that, like there's some people will sacrifice more, but it's like you have to find some sort of balance where you don't go nuts.
Mm-hmm.
But unless you're lucky enough to have like even when you've got like a huge padding financially, to just like work at something full time. I know people who have these expectations of like, oh, well, you know, I've got all this money in the bank. I'm just going to quit my job and I'm going to go make this game and I'll be done in a year. No, you won't. and I'll make like $10,000-$20,000 off of it. And it's like, no, you won't. And I'll just breeze through Greenlight and I'll be front page on Steam. It's like, no, you won't. I'm not trying to be extra pessimistic, but it's like, it's really hard to be like, to get into, like, it's easy to make a game, but it's very difficult to find an audience and to stand above other people who are also doing the exact same thing. And there are some exceptional games that are coming out, like, every month, every other week. And some of them just fall into obscurity or they just don't tap into, like, an audience. For whatever reason, because some other bigger game has come out and is just completely taken over. I mean, could you imagine trying to put out a game when, like, Breath of the Wild launched?
Yeah.
Like, there's not just, like, the big games you can see on the map. There's the games that you didn't see coming. And I don't really want to think about it, but I mean, like, probably a lot of people didn't think Owlboy was coming out. And I feel bad if we steamrolled anyone else. because we picked a time where it was just like nothing was going on and nothing was coming out for about 2-3 weeks, and nothing that was going to compete with Owlboy. And we were really lucky that we chose a really difficult month to launch, and we chose, like, we had that opportunity before, like, Watch Dogs 2 and some other big games were coming out. And I think a lot of other people would probably have the same idea. Oh, yeah, we'll get our game out beginning of November. And boom, there comes Owlboy. Just, like, it was like, I think we peaked. I had some metrics given, but we had, like, within a month, we had over a few, like, we had over 5 million minutes or 5 million somethings, like, worth of stream time and watch time within a month, just in November. It was like crazy how much attention we got on like Twitch and YouTube and everything like that, and how long we stayed in the top 10 for Steam. And it probably was completely disheartening to whoever was trying to get something out that week and, you know, couldn't break in because, like, this little out-of-nowhere game that nobody expected to finish just kind of, like, jumped up. And that's sort of, like, the weird reality is that sometimes that can happen to you, or sometimes you just, there's just too much stuff in general that's pretty good coming out, and it's really difficult to market things, to have a fan base, to get someone looking, and sometimes, you know, things just don't pan out, like a game just maybe isn't good, and, you know, you've spent a lot of time for what? And I still, like, want people to try, I still want people to, like, put in, like, all of their effort and, like, make the best damn thing they can, you know, have that, because what's more important than sales and success and all of that, I think, is just finishing a project and accomplishing something, getting to the end of a gigantic game or something that feels gigantic to you is more important, personally, emotionally, and everything like that. It gives you that sort of closure. It lets you reflect on the thing that you did and say, you know what, I could do this better next time, or I know exactly what to do next time, or I've got this cool idea that I really wanted to do while I was doing this, but I, you know, it gives you that discipline, and it also gives you that reflection, and it lets you just grow and do better and do whatever. It's for anyone who's trying to get into games, just finish them and put them out, and, like, before you have an audience, just try to finish things and make sure people can play them. Go to the TIG Source forums and put your game up and talk about it and show people what you have been learning. Post it on Twitter, post it on anything. Like, just like, be humble about it and just finish things. It's better to be known as a creator who finishes things and someone who's got a wasteland of half-eaten projects.
Sure. No, of course. And of course, you know, Owlboy is one of those successes, obviously. It came out, and like you said, it's had this universal positive reaction. I mean, people are still streaming on Twitch and everything. So to see that, I mean, again, that's just so heartening.
Yeah, super happy for you. Yeah. And, like, just wanted to say your hustle, like, super appreciated. I know how hard that could be.
Yeah.
So
It's been a long road. A lot of things have changed in life. You know, over 10 years, a lot of things happen. And that in itself can dictate where a project is going at the last minute, I guess. You know, some things can just change your mindset completely, and there is no kind of going back when you start going back to work or whatever.
Yeah. Well, how can people find the game? Where can they buy it? How can they give you money? That's the real question. That's where we are right now.
We need the Fry picture. You can get it on Steam. You can get it on Good Old Games. You can get it on Humble Bundle. Yeah, you can get it on all. Like, you can get it for Mac, Mac, Linux, Windows, PCs. We don't have any information we can give out just yet, but there are other languages and platforms coming. Soonish.
Okay.
we'll make announcements when that can actually be a thing. But you know, it's going to eventually be on everything. But for now, you awesome. Can find it on the PC.
Everything is usually pretty good. It's a good way to make more money. Adrian, how can people follow you specifically?
Well, I have a stupid little Twitter where I post dumb things and things I'm working on, mostly dumb things. It's just Adrian G. Bauer, AdrianGBauer. I don't have any crazy Twitter handles. I stopped having handles and things a long time ago. You can find DPad, just DPad Studio, on Twitter. You can find Simon Staffness, also on Twitter. You can find Jonathan Gear. He should be like Johnny Mark. You can find Henrik, but he never uses it. Joe Remy, who is like Joey Games on Twitter. You can find all of us nerds, just being huge nerds.
Well, I am making sure that all of our listeners will follow you. So, guys, you need to follow Adrian, everyone else associated with D-Pad Studios and Owlboy, and definitely purchase this game because, as John and I can attest, it's really enjoyable. So, Adrian, thank you so much for being on We Are Air today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Stop! Stop! Stop!